Welcome to New World Notes, edited by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear some more by Richard Heinberg. He's drawing connections among several world crises: peak oil, climate change, and a global economic system in ruins, to name three. Sounds like gloom and doom, but in fact, Heinberg's vision is optimistic. Why don't you stay tuned and find out why? Last week, we heard part of a fine talk by Richard Heinberg called Life After Growth: Why the Economy is Shrinking and What to Do About It. Today, we'll hear the rest of it, and we'll hear some more besides. Richard Heinberg is not a brilliantly original thinker, but I'm impressed by his mind all the same. He's good at surveying the research in many fields and drawing connections between one set of findings and another. These days, the world is awash in a flood of information, and we have a pressing need of people who can discern some useful patterns to the stuff. People who can see and show how A is connected to B, and B is connected to K, and it looks like all three are caused by S. That's what Richard Heinberg is doing in his speech. He's talking about how climate change is connected to the energy crisis, is connected to the collapsing world economy, and how all three of these crises are to a great extent results of a broader cause. And that cause is this: the entire global economic system, whose name is capitalism, depends on continuous growth. Growth in production of goods and services, growth in consumption, and growth in the money supply, which itself requires growth in debt. The entire system absolutely requires constant growth to function normally. But as Heinberg sees it, the planet Earth has reached its limit of growth. To cite two obvious examples, oil production and oil consumption can no longer keep growing. Sorry. Last week, we heard Heinberg talk about the three crises of energy, debt, and climate change. Then he just began to talk about the big bugaboo that underlies all three, the need for constant growth. This week, we'll hear him talk about doing without growth, about alternatives to growth. If you listened last week, you might like a brief review. And if you missed us last week, you might like a brief introduction, and I can offer both. I have a little movie produced by Heinberg's Post Carbon Institute. As far as movies go, it's not the best. It's like a synopsis. It's brief, and its words stay at a high level of generality. But that makes it good for our purposes. It's a good general overview of Heinberg's arguments, focusing on the underlying problem: capitalism's dependence on continuous growth. It's called Who Killed Economic Growth? And let's have a listen.
You've heard them. Politicians, economists, executives, all saying the same thing. The economy is recovering. Recovering to what? To its normal state of constant growth. In the next 5 minutes, we're going to see why they're wrong, why economic growth is effectively over, and what that means for the economy, for you, and for your family. It started a couple of centuries ago. There had been economic expansion before, but it was slow and cyclical. Empires rose and fell. But with the Industrial Revolution, rapid growth became normal. Economists tell us this was because of innovation, division of labor, increased trade. But it was mostly a result of cheap energy. It takes energy to do things, and with cheap coal and oil, people could suddenly do more than ever. First coal, and then oil sped up trade by fueling our prized inventions: railroads, automobiles, and airplanes. economists assumed that growth could go on forever. It was an absurd notion. Nobody stopped to think that all this industrial growth was happening on a small planet with only so much oil and soil, only so many forests and fish. We were growing on borrowed time. But we all got hooked on growth. Rising GDP numbers became our main measure of success. More, bigger, and faster meant better. The first warning sign came in the 1970s. A team of scientists programmed a computer with data about population growth, rising consumption, and resource depletion. Their conclusion, there are limits to growth. Mainstream economists attacked those findings using nasty rhetorical tricks, but 40 years later, the same conclusion holds. In fact, the industrial economies of the world's wealthy nations started stagnating years ago as resources began to run out. Governments, businesses, and households went into hock up to their eyeballs, gorging on easy credit. The financial system created ever more complex securities and derivative schemes to soak up all that debt and make perpetually rising imaginary profits on imaginary assets. But money and debt depend on natural resources. Piling up debt year after year, doubling it and doubling it again, meant piling up claims on resources that were shrinking as we depleted them. It was a pyramid scheme, the mother of all bubbles. And in 2008, it burst. Governments and central banks tried to reinflate the bubble with bailouts and stimulus packages funded by public debt. But there are practical limits to debt, and we're hitting them. There are practical limits to energy sources, and we're hitting them. There are real limits to the planet's ability to absorb our wastes and industrial accidents, and we've hit those too. We're being told that the economy is recovering, but take away new debt the government has taken on since 2008 to stimulate the economy, and there's been no real economic growth. There is no recovery. It's all been done with more debt. We've already mortgaged our grandchildren's future, but to keep the economy from relapsing, we'll need to borrow even more. The game is up. We've reached the end of economic growth as we've known it. They're lying to you. But they can't help it. We're all addicted to growth. We all want better jobs and higher returns on investments. But we live on a finite planet. The end of growth is not the fault of any one politician or political party, but some people benefited from growth more than others. We can live without economic growth, but we'll have to start doing a few things differently. We have to measure and aim for improvements in life that don't require increasing our consumption of fossil fuels and other depleting resources, or piling on more debt. Freedom, being with the people we love, good health and the time to enjoy it, a secure, happy community. We have to work together to build local economies where we can live and prosper. But, and this is a big but, without cheap fossil fuels and without borrowing from the future. The longer we put this off, the harder it will be. Economic growth, it's over. Let's move on.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? That's it.
There's Janis Joplin, pretty much in agreement with Hindberg, that constant growth, at least in consumer spending, is the problem. It's fun to write new, updated verses to that song. Ever try it? I have a modest example here. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a new iPhone 5? I can't think without one. I can't even drive. I've got to check Facebook, see if I'm still alive. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a new iPhone 5? Okay, back to Richard Hindberg. Here, in the latter part of his speech, he talks about the end of growth and the necessary adjustments we can make, and indeed how we can make civilization a much more livable place than it has been, though one with fewer Mercedes Benzes, fewer iPhones, and fewer bottles of apple juice shipped to New England from China, I kid you not. Here's Richard Hindberg.
Now, that just illustrates the absurdity of continuous compounded economic growth, which is what we all assume is going to happen in the future. Well, continuous compounded growth implies a doubling time. When we think of economic growth, we usually think of, well, you know, 3, 4, 5% per year. It sounds so innocent, right? Well, what's the doubling time? With 1% growth, the doubling time is 70 years. With 2%, about 35 years. And you can do the math yourself. China's been growing at a rate of about 10% per year. The doubling time is 7 years. So think about that. Every 7 years, the magnitude of China's economy doubles. The amount of coal that's being used, steel, cement, all the rest, pretty much doubles. Can China's economy double even one more time? I think it's entirely reasonable to hold doubts about that. And in fact, China's economy is slowing down, as are the economies of just about every other country on the planet. We have impacts baked in to the cake at this point. Climate impacts, environmental impacts of all kinds, economic impacts. So what we need to be doing is making other plans. Rather than promising more and more economic growth, as our both political candidates have been doing over the past few months, we should be thinking about what kind of economy will serve us in the future if it's a non-growing economy. Well, building resilience, I think, is a major tool, conceptual tool, in rethinking our economy in the era after growth. Resilience, of course, is the ability to absorb shocks and continue to function, reorganize and continue to function, which is what we'll all be needing to do as these shocks appear. So what does resilience look like on the ground? Well, it turns out it looks almost the exact opposite of what economic efficiency has looked like over the past few decades. Now, economic efficiency sounds like a good thing, too. I mean, energy efficiency is almost always a good thing. Why not economic efficiency? Well, sometimes it is. It's not always a bad thing, but think about it this way. If you can grow corn cheaper in Iowa than any place else, then shouldn't you grow all your corn in Iowa and nothing in Iowa except corn? That's economic efficiency. Or make all your widgets in China, okay? It may be economically efficient, but it gives you a more brittle food system or economy. And that's what we've done. We've made our economy maximally efficient, but minimally resilient. And now that we have impacts on the way, we have to dial back. We have to relocalize. Instead of continuing to globalize our systems, we have to relocalize. We have to build in inventories. You know, we've been reducing inventories everywhere we can. But if you live in a place, I live in California where we anticipate earthquakes. If you live in a place where you can, you know, reliably anticipate that at some point you're going to have a natural disaster, what do you do?
Well, you have some canned food and bottled water and a medical kit and so on. It's simple prudence. Well, every community should be thinking along similar lines. We need to be thinking about how we can relocalize our food systems, our energy systems, how we can reduce the need for transportation and transportation fuel so that if some of our current systems fail, let's say the global oil provisioning system fails for, you know, temporarily or permanently, well, if we're not depending on it so much, then we're not impacted so much. Getting off growth is something we can do. We know how to do it. Right now, we're largely locked into growth by virtue of the fact that we use GDP as our sole measure of economic health. You know, when we look at how a country is doing, almost the first thing we look at is what's its GDP and is what's the rate of GDP growth. But GDP doesn't tell us really very much about how happy people are, what's the state of the environment. You know, are people volunteering in community organizations? Or doesn't tell us any of those things. And in fact, GDP can go up as a result of very bad things. If we're having to spend a lot of money to recover from a disaster, or if we're putting more people in prison and it costs more to keep somebody in prison than they're likely to earn if they're outside, well, the GDP may go up. But do we want, you know, more and more people in prison and more disasters to recover from? More and more wars so we spend more money on armaments? No. So we should be looking at alternatives to GDP to measure how we're doing and to provide targets for where we want to get in the future. And there are good alternatives to GDP. The genuine progress indicator is being used increasingly in communities around the country. The whole state of Maryland has adopted it. A country, Bhutan, has adopted a different metric, which it calls gross national happiness. And they're proposing to the United Nations that the UN adopt GNH as a metric. Why worker ownership? Because the way we organize our economic lives right now is around corporations that go public and sell stock on Wall Street. And when they do that, by law, their first priority has to be maximizing returns to shareholders. Maximizing shareholder returns, okay? Which means that you have to grow or die. There's an imperative for growth that's built into the corporate system. But it doesn't have to be that way. With family-owned or worker-owned businesses or co-ops, businesses can function from year to year without necessarily having to grow. They can provide services and products for their customers. They can provide employment for their workers. And whether the economy is doing well or doing badly, they can continue. Whereas in the corporate world, it's dog eat dog. And we have to look at population stabilization and reduction. This isn't a very popular topic these days. But think about it. If the human population continues growing, but the economy doesn't, that means rather than an ever-growing pie with ever-growing slices for an ever-growing table, you know, that pie is going to be shrinking. So if there are more and more people at the table, everybody's going to be getting a smaller and smaller slice. The only way you can make this work without human tragedy on an unimaginable scale is to start thinking very seriously about population stabilization and reduction. And again, we can do this. We've discovered through trial and error over the course of the last few decades what works and what doesn't. It's just a matter of taking it seriously and implementing the policies. You know, there are lots of things we can do to deal with our energy and climate challenges. Among them, developing renewable energy sources. And that said, the reality is that those renewable energy sources are not going to enable us to maintain the kind of growing consumer economy that we've had since World War II, basically. It's just not going to happen. We've gotten started too late in the process. And renewable energy sources come with their own trade-offs. Solar and wind, for example, are intermittent sources of energy. The sun isn't always shining. The wind isn't always blowing. So if you're going to implement wind and solar, you also have to have storage capacity. You have to rebuild the grid in various ways. All of that costs a lot of money. And we just happen to be living in a moment of history where investment capital is getting harder to come by as a result of factors that we discussed earlier. So rather than assuming we can continue doing what we are doing now, but just with different energy sources, we're going to have to change what we're doing. All of the ways that we use energy in transportation, we have a less mobile future ahead of us. We will be traveling less, whether it's by car or plane. So we should be designing our cities and our lives, our communities, so that we don't have to travel as much in order to do what we need to do. We should be designing buildings that are self-sufficient in terms of energy, in terms of water. And again, we know how to do this. There are something like 20,000 buildings in Germany, which is a pretty cold, cloudy country, that produce all of their own heat and electricity. It's the passive house movement, and it's getting a start here in the United States as well. The technology design process is already there. It's just a matter of changing our building regulations and changing what we're aiming to accomplish. Finally, we've created a food system, a global food system, an industrialized food system that is virtually designed to fail under circumstances that are entirely foreseeable right now. We've created a food system that depends upon massive fossil fuel inputs at every stage along the way, from fertilizers to tractor fuel. And it's not working for us. It's making us unhealthy. It's a food system that's causing massive epidemics of obesity. Well, we can change that. We have thousands of models of local food systems, organic food systems, biodynamic, permaculture, on and on. It's not a lack of knowledge, it's a lack of application. We know how to solve all of the problems that we have. The problem is, the meta problem is, that what we're trying to do is maintain business as usual, whereas the solutions are ones that are going to actually require us to change business as usual. One of the most fundamental changes that's going to be required, I think, is in economics itself as a discipline. This is a discipline that's grown up just during these last couple of hundred years of anomalous economic growth. So economists have internalized the assumption that economies will always grow and can grow in perpetuity. Economists have internalized the assumption that the whole biosphere, the Earth's ecology, is just a subset of the human economy. It's a pile of resources that we extract and turn into manufactured products, which then become waste, which goes away, wherever that is. Of course, that's absurd. The entire human economy is a subset of the global ecosystem, always has been and always will be. So we should design the economy so that it functions like a healthy ecosystem. We have to understand that growth in both population and consumption is inherently unsustainable. You can grow these variables for a while, temporarily, but not for very long, and we're reaching limits in that regard. Renewable resources have to be harvested at less than the natural rate of replenishment. Duh. Isn't that so simple? And yet, we've built an economy that flouts that simple principle at every stage along the way, from topsoil. We lose 25 billion tons of topsoil every year, to our fisheries, and on, forestry. And finally, non-renewable resources have to be recycled, and the rate at which we extract them from the Earth's crust always has to decline if we're going to approach a condition of sustainability. Now, again, these are axiomatic principles. You can't really argue with them. But can we follow those principles and still build one of these? I don't know the answer to that question, but we seem to have decided over the course of the last 10 or 15 years that these are the most important inventions in all of human history, and we can't live without them. But how do we make these things? You know, using depleting, scarce, non-renewable resources and virtual slave labor and lots of fossil-fueled transportation at every stage along the way, it's an inherently unsustainable technology. Now, can we make these things out of local renewable materials using local highly paid labor? Maybe, but nobody's even trying to do that right now. So this is just an example of how differently we're going to have to begin to think at every stage, in every facet of our lives. Now, as we do this, I think it's going to be important to keep our attention on how we can actually improve life. by building resilience, by relocalizing our economies. Because in fact, we can do that. We can improve our lives. We've had to sacrifice an enormous amount for the sake of economic efficiency and economic growth. So, you know, none of these things, artistry, happiness, cooperation, health of the environment, none of these things depends upon having a fast-paced global economy. In fact, it could be argued that we had more of this stuff before we had all of the globalization and technological goodies and all the rest. So if we aim for a better quality of life rather than for increasing quantity of consumption, there's every reason to assume that the future can in fact be brighter, but only if we do so. Okay, so I know my message is challenging, but you know, we have to start from a place of recognition of where we are. What are the facts? We're an amazingly adaptable species. We can adapt to the challenges ahead of us if we're willing to recognize what they are and join together to make these changes. We're not going to be able to do it, each of us on our own, but we can do it as communities. We can do it working together. And my organization, Post Carbon Institute, offers all kinds of resources for doing that. You can look at our website, postcarbon.org, and find various research reports on unconventional fossil fuels and so on. Or you can look at our website, energybulletin.net, resilience.org, and find updated information on a daily basis about all of the things that I've been talking about over the past few minutes, from the economy to the environment to energy and more.
Richard Heinberg, finishing up a dandy talk he gave on November 2. His speech was recorded by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center and broadcast by Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Many thanks to both. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Or find us again on the airwaves at this community radio station. That might be WWUH West Hartford, WHUS Storrs, or WAPJ Torrington, all in Connecticut. Or it might be KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho. Or WIEC in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Or Radio Free Brighton in Brighton, England. Wherever, please remember to support your alternative community radio station. They'd be glad to have a gift of your money, or if that's not a good option for you, they'd be glad to have your gift of some volunteer time. So please get in touch with them. I don't ask for any money, but I'd be glad to have your comments and suggestions on the show. So please feel free to get in touch with me too. You'll find my email address stated at the website. And once again, the website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And I'm pretty sure I speak for the entire New World Notes staff when I say, again, thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.